This interview has been brought to you by the Omega Center. The Omega Center is an online forum striving to facilitate a deepening of consciousness, conversation, and connection as we seek God in our scientific age. This website is dedicated to the education, formation, and inspiration in the converging fields of science and theology, and exists to promote and support the work of Ilya Delio. Ilya joins us on Skype to discuss what this month of December has been like for so many of us. A strange feeling of dislocation has started to set in, and as we anticipate what January holds, both in terms of a new beginning and maybe the fear of the new beginning, particularly in our country as we face the inauguration of our next president. Some of us are feeling a little bit terrified. We've been exploring some of these ideas about Advent and love and evolution in the midst of what feels like absolute chaos. One of the questions that I've been wrestling with in the midst of all of this is, what is the role of memory? How does that impact how we think about the future? We'll cover that and some other questions in this interview. Full disclosure, I had a massive head cold when we recorded this, so my apologies. Bear with us. I was looking at these praxis questions. I just think they're they're a great summary of what we're all kind of experiencing right now. So I thought we would kind of just go through them if that sounds good.
Sure.
Eileen wrote, "Our world has become very fragile with thin defended borders between people. The heightened sense of insecurity due to the political instability and global economic and climate pressures seems to be provoking an environment of growing discouragement and distrust. In light of these conditions," these are the things that we invited all of our subscribers and our readers to enter into. So here's the first question. If love, as Teilhard suggests, is at the heart of the cosmos, how can this reality shape our lives in spite of the challenging conditions and negative messages that are just swirling around us?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think to consider love as our root reality is to realize that we are not in this fragile world alone. And here's maybe what I want to try to explore a little bit, which I did in a recent blog for NCR. I think we have created a world, a culture of consumerism. And it's not so much the material goods themselves. It is rather the habit of placing our ultimate values on material goods. And this, I think, coupled with the idea of knowledge, status, power, this autonomous I, you know, the autonomous self. And what we kind of know, or what we're experiencing, is the self cannot remain autonomous, that the self is by nature a relational self. It is deeply rooted in a whole, and we can name that ultimate whole at the heart of our reality as God, or as love, as divine love. And so in some ways, I think deep down, if we were to drill all the way down to the fundamental levels of our humanity, we would find ourselves enmeshed in one another, because we're deeply entangled in this wholeness of love. And yet when you come up to the surface of our everyday existence, we're acting as separate, isolated, existent particles. And because our real reality is relationality, we don't act well when we're isolated, separate, and in conflict with one another. In fact, we're on the verge of extinction at every moment. And so I think that the difficulty is consumerism has lured us into believing that the isolated I is the real one, you know, and all we have to do is kind of placate it with more stuff, you know, more cars, more clothes, more shoes, more technologies, you know, more trinkets. And the more we consume, the more unhappy we're becoming, because we're increasingly isolated from our root reality. And why I say this is that if I think of someone like St. Francis of Assisi, where, you know, his journey to the root reality of love was downward and inward. In other words, he dispossessed himself of the stuff that clogged his life from really being open to that root relationality of love. And so that poverty of spirit or gospel poverty that he really sought to live was kind of not so much not having things, but not allowing things to control, you know, or to possess those things, like to use things to create our identities or to use things to create our status and our power. And so this idea of dispossession is really, I think, a fundamental one. I think we do need to get back to the gospel. We need to reread the Beatitudes, the first Beatitude of blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That was never meant to be like, if I give my stuff away, I'm going to go to heaven. I think what it means is if I dispossess myself of the needs for power, control, stuff, you know, that I have to build myself up, I block myself from seeing the root reality of love in which I am already in the midst of. And so heaven is that, you know, unfold, that kind of clear vision of the relationship with divine love, in a sense that we already have the potential of by even our, you know, our earthly life. So I think we're sort of on a downward spiral, quite honestly, because we can't get ourselves out of the ism of consumerism. We're kind of locked in its grip, and we are really enslaved to a culture we've created. And so I think we do need to begin to make some radical choices, you know, for our lives. Like, what will it take to create the inner space, the poverty, where we can trust one another, surrender, you know, believe that love is in our midst, believe that we're created out of love, that what we're called for is to deepen that love with one another, you know, into a greater unity. I don't think it's a matter of does this love exist or not, because our very kind of drivenness for moreness, you know, which is thwarted by consumerism. So our moreness gets thwarted by more cars, more stuff, more clothes, more shoes, more houses, more things, where the moreness we really want is more love, more consciousness, more being, you know, in a way that togetherness enhances my own uniqueness, you know, and doesn't swallow me in that, you know, relationship. So I think Teilhard's vision, and not so much vision, maybe his tapping into love as our root reality, is what's being held out to us now as a choice. Do we want to be in the really real, or do we want to be in the artificial, you know, of things, the artificiality of things?
Yeah. So go ahead.
So I think we need to make a choice for the real, you know?
Yeah. I'm thinking about what that real is as you describe it, this foundational relationality that we're sort of moving out and away from as we go further up into surface reality or artificial reality, as you're saying. Like, what drives that? And I'm thinking about the role of desire, and in particular the way, and I know I mentioned this to you a minute ago, but the role in which our memory impacts how and what we desire. And Teilhard has this capacity to give us a much broader, deeper, and older memory, because it strikes me that it's not just the consumerism that is plaguing us, but that deep down the desire with that consumerism is, who am I? How do I identify myself?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I make sense of my place in this world? And so we've unknowingly given in to this trap that we express ourselves and determine who we are by the stuff that we have or the way we accumulate our lives, whether it's through jobs, possessions, experiences instead
and
of...
And it could be, yeah, the stuff is not only material, it's also spiritual, it's psychological, it's everything we hold on to. You know, it's everything we stuff our lives with. And even memory, you know, if I can just, I know I interjected here, but, you know, even memories, we hold on to past memories.
Right.
You know, things that happened 30 and 40 years ago. Well, you're way too young for that.
But that's exactly what I'm talking about. This is why I think there's two memories that we hold at the same time. We have our finite memory, which is what we tend to get stuck in and hang on to and identify with, of I was born here and then this happened to me and I'm really upset about this and my parents were this and because of that, now this. And so we build a whole story that we are hanging on to and clinging to as our very identity. When in reality, our memory is much older. Like if we open up and release that finite memory, we're able to enter into a deeper, older evolutionary trust and knowing that we are actually relational, that we're not in this alone. So I don't know if any of that made sense, but I just have this instinct that we are operating under a false notion of identification of who we are.
Yeah, no, that's good, Bri. And I might put it this way. I think we have partially numb memories. We've become unconscious. Part of our memory capacity has been blocked out. And I think it comes from what I've talked about in other places as a divided brain. You know, that kind of, I think that kind of compartmentalizing religion, compartmentalizing our interior lives from our everyday lives, from our everyday world. And so I think there's a part of our memory that's just in deep sleep. Mm-hmm. And so we have forgotten.
Yes.
And so the sadness of memory is, you know, maybe the sin of memory is to forget. Mm-hmm. And I think what we have forgotten is not so much the past. That's, I think that kind of clinging to the past is part of our partial memories, you know. Yes. Because it's sort of like left brain, if you can talk about left brain memory, I'm not sure, but you know, we're good on the data, we're good on the events, the particular events. Mm-hmm. I think what has become numb or asleep is what I might call whole brain memory, and that's, I think, memory of the future. Mm-hmm. I think memory is not only of the past, memory is what we're created for, you know, in a sense. I think that memory is that being member too.
Yes.
You know, we remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, we remember by being member too. And I think our creation story, you know, even from Genesis, we've always read it as a past story. But I think that's a future story. Hmm. You know, this is what we are to remember, what we're created for, and that is wholeness. But that we can only remember that if we have sort of an integrated whole of a mind, you know, a full functioning memory that says, you know, it's not, you know, don't just hold on to the past memories because that's a partial self, you know, in a sense that's dead self. The memories, I think memory, like history, like evolution, memory is sublative. Memories that nurture life are memories that live in the moment as part of the creating future. You know, so there's no such thing as like, you know, what happened 30 years ago is what you are today, you know, or what happened 10 years ago is what you are today, because the events of our lives are always being sublated. They're being taken up into what we're becoming. Mm. And so memory is always pointing us towards something, you know, but we've made it this past thing. And by doing that, I do think we live with not just thwarted lives, I mean, really snuffed out, you know, lives, because like Beatrice Bruchot, I think, said it so well, we live with like the fossils of dead remains, you know, when we try to hold on to something past. There is no past. You know, even what scientists are discovering about time today, you know, in terms of quantum time, past, present, and future are just sort of constructs that we create to kind of allow us to organize the events of our lives. But in terms of time, the past is the present, and the present is unfolding into future. You know, so in this moment, in terms of quantum time, is past, present, future. Mm-hmm. So even in terms of memory, you know, it's past, present, future.
Right.
You know, so
right.
I don't know if this makes sense,
no,
but all I'm
it does. Is that yeah, I think that there's that we have a tendency for linearity, and
mm-hmm.
we want to organize in a line that starts at A and then moves to B and then goes to C. But I was recently reading some articles about time, like you were mentioning, and the fluidity and flexibility of that reality that isn't at all, it isn't at all linear. That the future is creating the present in a way. It's calling us forward into the present. It isn't cause and effect like we used to think.
Right.
That this one thing here is going to move a marble and the marble is going to move over
exactly.
there.
Exactly. Yeah, that kind of Newtonian fashion of
mm-hmm.
A, you know, B. A new Scientific American has a new article, an article this month on quantum entanglement and space-time.
Mm.
That quantum entanglement may be a way of understanding the emergence of space-time and this idea of qubits, you know, that there's miniature entangled particles that have given rise to space-time. And I do think, you know, what if, you know, I do think we need to begin to think of divinity and created reality in terms of entanglement. More and more, I think that is a much more appropriate model of relationship between divine and created than this image, you know, the concept of image.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in other words, if we are entangled with God, you know, from all eternity, then there's something of that within us, you know, that the memory of eternity itself is pulling us onward towards something.
That's right.
You know, towards something more whole and,
yeah.
and more life-giving.
Yeah, my instinct is almost like what you're saying is that our memory is almost like our DNA. It's who we are actually created to be and become. It's not so much this limited story that we've created and obsessed
right.
with in the past, but rather this whole past, present, future time becoming.
Right.
Yeah, the whole of it coming into being is that memory, to be membered to that bigger picture.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And I think what you mentioned in the beginning, you know, the intertwining of memory, desire, and will, very Augustinian, you know, really appropriate. But again, we have singled these out or compartmentalized these things, memory, intellect, and will, or memory, mind, and will. You know, and what we're seeing is the widened capacity of our memory is the deepening of our desire, and then, therefore, you might say the focusing of our desires towards something.
Yes.
And so, you know, if we can get out of this kind of historical, linear, thwarted, partial notion of memory as something in the past that we keep holding on to and we preoccupy our little minds with, and widen that memory to something deeper, more whole, more future, more creative,
mm.
you know, our desires would be widened.
Mm.
We have very small desires, you know, and that's, I think this is part of the difficulty today is our desires are so limited and small. Like our hope is that we can get up in the morning and just have a good day. You know, we don't think big. And this is actually, this, For all our inventions in the modern era, this actually does distinguish us from the medieval person or even the patristic person who thought much more widely than we do. If you look at the medieval writers or even some of the patristic writers like Gregory of Nyssa, their sense of desire and memory was so cosmic. It was
yeah.
of the whole,
yeah.
you know, and I don't know if we're just sort of frightened by such a large universe that we're in that we can't even think this large, but we are being, you know, I think we need to feel at home in this universe
mm.
and think as wide and as expansive as the universe
mm.
and think, you know, and think and focus our desires to the capacity of the infinite,
mm.
you know, and not be so stifled in our, you know,
yeah,
not
yeah.
be so small. You know, like, I hope I get through this week or I hope I get through this day. You know, really, is that the extent of it? I mean, what's at the heart of our lives? You know, that's like maintenance mode, you know, I think. It's just, we're talking about a maintenance God here, not a God who is infinite in love, incomprehensible in love, a, you know, the absolute wholeness of love, who is our future. Thank you.
Yeah, and that plays into the capacity for us to trust, right? Because if you're talking about memory as something that's future, not just past, and that how that memory impacts our desire and our will and what we live for, really, then having a memory that includes this future of trust changes how we can desire and the fluidity and the freedom with which we can have imagination and belief. And one thing that strikes me as fascinating, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this, is as our world is getting shaken up and people are starting to freak out with good reason, there's also this surge of really radical creativity and new thinking. Like I was watching this new show on Netflix where it's the premise of it is the capacity of human beings to travel through dimensions and where time is not linear, you know. And I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, like, there's some good science and some good theology to this. Like, where is this coming from? But, you know, like, these ideas aren't happening in isolation. And there's a few movies that are out right now that deal with the nature of consciousness, the nature of time, what we might be capable of. And I sense that in the arts, we're beginning to round out or desiring to round out what has become so flattened in rationality and in scholasticism. No, this is how reality is. You know, we've created these neat little boxes. And now as things are getting shaken up, I don't know, maybe this is an opportunity for us to reimagine ourselves and remember the potential of who we can become.
Yes, I think that's true, Bri. I think there is a lot of creative thinking going around. I see a lot of initiatives all over. I think the difficulty for us, and here's maybe where I would step back and look at a broader picture here, we have created a culture, and I'm not just talking about North American culture, I mean a commodified culture that is now globalized. And I think we are going to suffer. Let me just put this very shorthand. For all the creativity that abounds, it is not enough to produce a critical mass to cross a threshold into a new level of existence. Mm. And I think it's hopeful because it says to us that we are not satisfied with being isolated, alienated, in conflict with one another. There's something that's deep within us that longs for a more unified, a more just world, a world where we really can share life together. But I do think there's going to be a great suffering before there's a new level of emergence towards a new level of existence. I do think technology can help us, but, you know, technology is certainly not the cure-all for moving ahead. And it is sort of the nature of evolution, and that is suffering and death must precede the emergence of new life. And I think for all the good that's taking place, I also see a dying that's taking place.
Yeah.
And this is maybe my own, maybe prophetic insight, that I do think that something, a great demise is going to take place in our world in the not too distant future, you know. And while it will be very hard for us, it's going to throw us together again. And all our animosities, our polarities, our biases, our prejudices, you know, all of that is going to disappear because we will need one another in a new way. And I think, you know, I think we will rise up again, but with a new sense of what it means to belong, you know, to a planet, to a whole. So that's maybe where I see. I think love, God. I think God is love. Love is at the heart of our universe, and that love is unconditional. It is absolute. It will not fail us. And I do think we are being invited every moment to trust that love. But I also think we need to have wider eyes to see the kind of world we've created for ourselves. And unless we had a critical mass turnaround, you know, towards a radical way of a radical living in poverty of spirit, in simplicity, in unity, in justice, you know, unless we could cross a threshold, you know, and create a critical mass to produce a new threshold, I don't see an entirely positive future up ahead without suffering.
You know, I mean, you're not the first person that I've heard say this. In the last month, I feel like I've heard a number of spiritual teachers kind of with the similar intuition that this shift in consciousness that is required of us is going to go through the eye of the needle of suffering, because that's part of how we do, as Teilhard intuited, that is the ascensional force of the universe, that there is something cosmically bonding that happens through pain and through suffering. And so one question that I have is, with that bigger, broader memory view of the future and trust, how do we maintain trust as we move into what undoubtedly may be a time of great discomfort and suffering? How do we hold the tension of that, or how do what is our role to play? How do we mediate that transition of consciousness?
I would say the most fundamental focus of our lives should be on the interior life. In other words, I think we need to, and there's two things. I think we need to focus on the interior life, and I think we need discipline. Mm-hmm. We need to practice priorities of life. Oops, hold on here. I think we need to make choices. In other words, we need to practice trust. We need to practice surrender. We need to practice poverty, poverty of spirit, the letting go. You know, and that's everything from, you know, people say things, you know, that we don't like, or, you know, someone does something that we don't like. I mean, what we have kind of grown accustomed to is we say whatever comes the first thing to our heads, you know, or we feel it's our right. We can say it as it is. Well, I think what we're realizing is it doesn't work. I mean, what we have is just a lot of emotionalities, you know, and not rationalities. We need to be able to think again. I think we've lost the capacity to really think in a way that we're thinking unto love. You know, we're thinking in a way that unifies. We're thinking in a way that brings about a deeper relationship. We become emotionally reactive. I mean, you see this in the news, you see it, you know, certainly in the internet and all the little things that pop up. So I would say practice setting your priorities in order. Practice trust. Practice surrender. Practice letting go. You know, and that means when you have the opportunity, make the choice. And it's all about will. You know, and an untrained will or an undisciplined will are random desires, you know, and forgetfulness. The three things that we talked about before.
Yeah.
You know, where you are unfocused in your desires are all over the place, and when they're all over the place, you really cannot remember what you're created for. Mm-hmm. And so what we tend to do is, I think we move from the higher brain to the lower brain. Mm-hmm. We move from neocortex to primitive cortex, and we become, you know, sort of like, I don't want to say on par with the animals, because I think sometimes my cats are more more thoughtful than me. But I think we can become sort of primitive in just being emotionally reactive, or we're vindictive, or we just, you know, we want to get back at that person, you know. And you see this more and more. I think we're living on the level of paleocortex a lot these days, and not neocortex.
Yeah. I hear that reactivity. I see that. I notice it. I'm aware of it in my own life and in my own practice. It's easier for me to connect with the idea of letting go and surrender when it comes to negativity, right? So, like, I get that I'm supposed to let go of unhelpful comments or not get hooked on triggers and the rest of it. What do you say about how we are to navigate that which is calling us into what might be a more holistic movement or desire? I think, here's my question, I think at times we take this approach to, like, non-duality as passive, or, well, I guess if I'm supposed to let go and surrender to everything, then I'm just going to end up completely alone and like a hermit in like a, you know, a tiny little hut. Don't laugh, because that's what my life looks like at the moment. But, like, you know, so how do we, how do how do we know what to trust is calling us into a deeper union desire, relationality, relationship? How do we differentiate between what we need to let go of and what we need to move toward?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, you know, I think it's in some ways, I would say, I might reframe that question as, where is your heart? You know, and I think the gospel, you know, I love that line from the gospel, where your, you know, heart is, there your treasure lies. And it's as simple as that. Where is the core of our being? Is it with God or not? You know, is it with the absolute wholeness of love or not? Is it within us, you know, in union? Is it walking with one, with that oneness of God or not? And so I think at every breath, you know, really at discernment is every breath of life, we have to say, you know, what is, you know, what is breathing through me? What is impelling me to make this choice? What have I forgotten when I get angry, or, you know, I become like not thoughtful of my reaction to people and my response? How do I choose? And you know, life is, so the surrender thing and the trust, you know, trust factors, I mean, what we are saying is life is an active participation all along the way. And so it's like, I think here I find the desert mothers and fathers really to be outstanding models, because they were a little wacky, I would agree. They made radical choices, right?
There's all sorts of
takes on, you know, what drew them to the desert. But there is something about, I think what still speaks to us today is we need to make radical choices. We don't make radical choices. We make sort of short-term choices, you know, like I like Pepsi over Coke, or, you know, I like Dorito chips over potato chips. Or I don't like you, so I'm going to unfriend you, you know. So there's no depth. I think maybe what I'm finding today is we lack depth. And I think this is why we need to make a choice for silence, for solitude, for just sitting, you know, 10 minutes a day quietly, you know, without thinking anything. And then I think we need to train our minds. I mean, we do know that the mind is plastic. So I think we need to make some radical choices. And I think, you know what the thing is? Because we have lost sense of community, here's the thing. We do better to make radical choices when we know we're not alone. We make less radical choices when we feel alone, because it is sort of a fight or flight thing. If we feel alone, then our first tendency is to preserve ourselves. And so we're going to do all that it takes to preserve my little self. But if we're with others, I think this is the value of community. You know, then we support one another, right? We don't feel alone. So we can then choose, you know, for a more simple way of living, or we can make more radical choices with regard to food or with regard to the poor, whatever it is. So I do think we need two things. We need radical choices we need to belong to someone or some group or something, and to know ourselves belonging, you know. And then I think we need to train our minds. Our minds, you know, cannot just take everything that comes along into, you know, which is what we do. We have sort of undiscerning minds. You know, everything comes in and we don't know how to make sense of a lot of this. You know, it's like all is junk. So I said this somewhere, I think, and, you know, we have junk food minds.
Yeah.
It's just like junk food, you know, fast food will make you overweight and bloated and diseased. So I think the same thing with our minds. We have sort of minds that are overweight, bloated, and diseased and diseased. Because they're not whole, they're not integrated, they're not functioning with depth and vision and future.
I'm feeling as well that perhaps one of the side effects of this shift into the bigger memory is also a reconnection. Like, you know, you were saying, it's to be membered to, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that sense of, like, what we use in the Christian language all the time of to be one body, to form one body, to remember that we are one body. And, mm-hmm. you know, I was kind of thinking it's somewhat ironic, you know, that we use so much language of embodiment and we're so terrible at it. But that might be part of the disconnect. Maybe part of what is blocking us to the older memory is that we don't even know how to be in our own bodies. We're so afraid of pain or discomfort. We don't even know how to hold it within ourselves. And that maybe that is part of what contributes to that addictive mind that's just sort of grasping at straws and trying to stay distracted is, you know, that we've lost that connection to the whole within ourselves as well as the broader whole too, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I do think the disconnected self is the disconnected world, you know. I think everything that we call world is emerging out of what is the self. And so I think creating a culture that disconnects the self is creating a world that is disconnected and unrelated. And so I think the first task is to find true relationality within, and then we create, you know, a new world of relationality without. I think that's the Teilhardian flow of the within and without, you know, consciousness and love. You know, the more I am at home with myself, I am aware of belonging to an other. Or as Simone Weil said, you know, whoever says I lies, you know, is no I. There is no ego apart from, you know, a thou or I apart from a thou. And so I think, you know, it's coming to recognize the thou at the heart of myself, you know, and then out of that deep relational self, I then, you know, contribute and participate in the relational world. And so I think we have mutated egos, you know, they're truncated, they're cut off, and they now seem isolated. We've created a culture that isolates the ego. And so I think we have eyes that are just deeply longing for a vow but don't even know where to find it anymore. And so, you know, I think this is the path of the wisdom traditions. You know, the first place to look is in the self, in the heart, in the soul.
And that actually gives us a really good way, a good practice, an entry into practice, because I'm thinking of the poet Rilke, how he says that love is actually to become a world unto yourself, you know, to be a whole world for a whole nother world, you know, and for the other. And so perhaps part of our practice as we move into this next season, as we start this new year, is to consider ourselves as a whole world, not in isolation from other people, but just like our world is not in isolation from the universe, like we are in this kind of cosmic dance together, but to really begin to look at ourselves and observe our behavior and our actions and our what storylines we're operating out of, how are our choices saying something about what we believe about, you know, from what we eat to who we spend time with to how we interact online to what we're doing with a broader, you know, lack of imagination. So, yeah, I guess I'm thinking of some practical takeaways of how we can begin thinking about the new year. You know, so many people like to do these
resolutions.
There we go. That's the word. Yep. Resolutions. So, yeah, what would be like the Teilhardian approach, the Omega Center approach to taking inventory in a deep way with depth?
Yeah.
Not just a shallow list of things that I'd like to do or change about myself, but a real pause. How could we do that together?
Yeah, I think three things. We need to slow down. We need patience. And we need to trust. Now, it would be really interesting. You know, we have the ecological footprint quiz. We should do something comparable for, like, for the soul, you know, or for the inner self. Like, where do we, or for the mind, if we can call it the mind. And I mean mind as that kind of realm of consciousness and heart and everything.
The holographic mind. Yeah.
The holographic mind. We should have a holographic mind quiz. Where are our minds at any one moment, you know, and really take note of how thinned out we've become because we allow so much stuff to cross, you know, to pass through us. And we're taking it all in and and we can't respond to it all. And so we're by the end of the day, I think we're all over the place, you know. So I think the first thing we need to do is the practice of contemplation or the practice of meditation or just the practice of being present. And that means just take 5-10 minutes a day and just sit still. Don't do anything. Don't read anything. Don't think anything. Don't listen to anything. Just be, you know, and just, you know, as the ancients did, just attend to your breathing, you know, the breaths of life. And then I think we need to begin to learn to practice letting go, because I think we have developed a culture of possessiveness. Mm. That's possessiveness, not only of material things, possessiveness of power, possessiveness of people, possessiveness of ideas, you know, possessiveness of opinions, possessiveness of emotions. And all these possessions have made us stuffed up with ourselves. And so we have no room for anyone else to enter in or any new idea to enter in. So I think what we need to do is to let go. You can have your opinion, but let it go. It's okay, you know. And then the third thing, I think, is to trust others. We don't trust, because we possess, we don't trust one another. You know, so we're always like slightly skeptical or cynical of others. We're pretty sure either they're out to get us, they're really trying to manipulate us. We have this really pervasive, I think, we've developed a pervasive culture of distrust. If, you know, if it's not exactly my thought, or you don't look exactly like me, or, you know, you don't do what I do, then I'm a little bit suspicious of you. Right? And so we don't trust that we're really in this together, you know? That, you know, what we ultimately want is to share life. And I think we need, I think we need new language, quite honestly.
Yeah.
I think we need to get rid of a lot of the words in our English language and just think of the word person, you know, person. Even when we, you know, encounter the things of nature, you can think of things as personal leaves or personal ants. That everything that exists has personality, you know, even if it's a primitive form of personality. But all the language that we have accumulated to describe, you know, a lot of our adjectives have actually become divisive now. And so I think we need new language. Keep it simple. Love, person, relationship, trust, peace, you know. Maybe we don't agree on things. Maybe we don't see things, you know, the same way. Maybe the way you do things is not the way I do things. But it's okay. And so we need another word. Difference, maybe. But, you know, difference can unify if we can appreciate that the way you're doing things is not the way I do things. But maybe it kind of enhances the vision of doing anything, you know. So, anyway, those are just some thoughts for the new year on how we might begin to rebuild a very fragile and now downward spiraling culture of isolated eyes.
Yeah, so what's coming to me and what you're saying is as we pause, hopefully have the space to pause, which is what I'm hearing you encourage us to do, to take the time to take inventory of where we are and to also make a commitment to discipline moving into this new year. That these practices of letting go, the practices of meditation, is actually patterning a wholeness, a trust, that will allow us to continue to let go and be in the flow of evolution, which is so creative and is wanting to create something new. And I think that's the other side of the trust question that I was wrestling with earlier is, you know, I get letting go of the negative, but when we encounter something positive and beautiful, we also sometimes want to cling to it and hang on to
right.
it. And the fear there is that if we don't, it's going to go away. If I don't hang on to this, like it might go away and like I can't bear it. But the surrender in that setting, with what you're saying, is trusting that there's something bigger happening through that, that we can let go of our small tendency to hang on to it and surrender to the flow of creativity that is wanting us to co-create a new reality.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Well said. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Ilya. Appreciate your time and Happy New Year.
Thank you, Bree, and thanks to all. Happy New Year and abundant blessings in the fullness of love.
To continue these conversations and explore a little bit more about these topics we've been talking about, be sure to visit omegacenter.info. There you will find weekly blogs on the topics of science and theology, and you can become a member. Happy New Year, everybody.